said to my husband, I need to structurally revise myself. So I downgraded to something.
The Committee on Public Safety Finance will come to order. We will have the Department of Public Safety start going through its budget for us. And I believe we have Commissioner Michael Campion and Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison who will be walking us through the information. Welcome today on this nice snowy day.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety, and Mary Ellison is the Deputy Commissioner. She is at the table in the bright red outfit next to me. We are going to, Madam Chair and members, give a high-level overview of the Governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Public Safety. The Governor, for the 2008-2009 biennium, his budget is $605 million in direct appropriations. This budget consists of $205-plus million from the state's general fund and $399-plus million from all other funds. And this budget represents a 22.3% increase over fiscal year 2006-2007. The funding for DPS is comprised of 28% from the trunk highway funds, 34% from state general funds, 35% from special revenue funds, and 3% from the highway user tax distribution fund. Mary Ellison will go over some of the specific budget recommendations from the governor, and Madam Chair and members, we have a number of our division directors here, so any questions that you would have, we certainly should have the people here that will be able to answer those.
Great, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Public Safety. What I did was I passed out a one-page sheet with material on each side, and then I know that you also have your budget books in front of you. So what I thought I would do is, as the Commissioner said, we thought we would review the budget initiatives that Governor Pawlenty has put forward for the Department of Public Safety today. Last time when we were here, we did an overview of the department, so today we're going to focus on these budget initiatives, and as the Commissioner said, we have people here that can go into as much detail on each one of these initiatives as you would like. So I will start out. What I will do is just, you know, go over the bullet points that are on this page and then direct you to the page in the budget book where there's greater detail that you can refer to now or later, and then just open it up for any questions that people have.
That sounds good. Thank you.
First of all, on the page is the Armor 911 system. That budget change item is on page 83 of your budget books, if you want to look at it in detail. I hope your numbers are the same as ours. I'm assuming that they are. This basically is an initiative that allows the state to complete the build-out of the statewide interoperable public safety communication system, or as we refer to it as ARMOR. It provides basically the authority to change the 911 fee from its current 75 cents per month to no more than 75 cents in 09, and in 010 up to 95 cents, and then in 09 at 85 cents. So basically what it does is it provides the authority to the Commissioner of Public Safety to raise the fee by 10 cents per year to collect the funds so that we can continue to so that we can complete the build-out of the ARMOR system. And then it allows the Commissioner of Finance to sell revenue bonds to pay the capital costs of completing the ARMOR system.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair and Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, in the funding of this ARMOR system, that is part of what fees? Is that phone bill or is that, where's that money coming from?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, it comes from your phone bill, both landlines and cell phones. So we each pay 65 cents a month on each one of our phones. This would give us the authority to increase that up to 95 cents over a three-year period of time to pay for the build-out of the ARMOR system.
Okay.
Senator
Madam
Foley?
Chair and Ms. Ellison, I'm looking at fees, period, so I'm kind of interested in where all these are, because we're running into some severe criticism where we're taking building up a fee, where an example might be that you've got somebody that's got a stop sign violation, and what used to be a $10 fine is now $195 or something when you include all of the fees there. And what I'm looking for is somewhere we can get control of those so that we aren't doing that kind of a problem. And while what you have there in the armor is only a small piece, that when you get into these other areas, it adds up in a hurry. And so ultimately, I want to look at these as we go through.
Thank you.
And next, Commissioner Ellison, it also, in the budget book, it looks like this is replacing trunk highway funds. Am I understanding that correctly?
Senator Higgins, I don't believe so, but let me ask Ron Whitehead to come to the table. He knows more about this area.
My name is Ron Whitehead. I'm the director of the Armor 911 program in Department of Public Safety, and there is some allocation of trunk highway fund to the trunk highway fund, offsetting the operating costs. And one of the additional features that the governor's recommended is that we cover the cost of operating the system, so that as we move out, that there is no cost if for those users on the backbone of the system throughout the state. So that's the only funds that's going, I believe it's approximately $3.11 million would go to the trunk highway fund. And MnDOT, as the owner and operator of the system, has been charging those back, in the case of the metropolitan area, some of those fees to the metropolitan area, and was looking to, it was the question of assessing those to the users or coming up with a revenue stream to fund it into the trunk highway fund for their cost of operating the system.
Okay, now I'm more confused.
I'm sorry. MnDOT owns and operates the system, which means they, you know, provide the maintenance for the system, they upgrade the system, and so forth. Those funds, they cover those costs out of the trunk highway fund, but then we reimburse the trunk highway fund for those costs of operating the system.
Okay. That was really clear. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question. The backbone of the system is going to be paid out of these revenues that are going to be generated throughout the next couple, 2 or 3 years. Is that correct? In other words, the capital that the state would actually put out to build the backbone is going to be the big expense here. Is that fair to say?
Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that would be correct. It would be the 911 fee would cover the debt service for 911 revenue bonds. That's what we've done in phase three, was Department of Finance sold revenue bonds, and we're paying the debt service with the 911 fee to cover that debt service for those bonds. The most recent bonds were 11-year bonds.
Okay, so, Madam Chair?
Senator.
Follow-up question then. When these are paid off, is there any talk of the governor's office or your organization about reducing those fees again, get back to where they were, or would that kind of money be needed to maintain the operation?
Mr. Whitehead.
Chair and Senator, those obviously 11 years from now, the will of the legislature can change quite a bit over that period of time. But once the debt service is, we've already provided for operating costs. Once the debt service is covered, those fees could be reduced at that time. You're correct.
Thanks.
Okay, Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that when I was there, when we first started talking about the 911 fee, and it started currently at the 65 cents, was it contemplated all along that there will be an incremental increase in that fee to built in to finance each phase of the build-out?
Mr. Whitehead?
Chair and members of the committee, the 911 fee has been predominantly the way of financing. The radio system started in 1997 when 4 cents was allocated to the Metropolitan Radio Board. Then again in 2002 when there was funding that was authorized from the 911 fee, and wasn't able to go because of some issues with the 911 fund, and ultimately in 2005 when the legislature increased the fee to provide for phase three. So that over the years, the 911 fee has been the revenue stream of choice, obviously, to fund that. And there clearly is some recognition of the fact that getting to the PSAP and getting the information to the squad cars, there's some logical connection there. It's related to getting those public safety officials out to the scene, and there is some interconnection and some logic to that choice.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, my question was that when we settled on the 65 cents per month, was it contemplated that number was enough, and so that's why we settled with that number? Or was it built into the discussion that we would start out with the 65 cents per month in 2005, and then in 2009 you will come back for the 75 cents and we will phase that in? And if it wasn't originally contemplated, then what's the rationale for increasing it from 65 to 75 and then ultimately to 95? I get 85 and the 95.
Mr. White.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in 2005, it was clearly understood by the legislature, I believe at that time, that the increase to 65 cents would only cover the phase three implementation. So there was no per se discussion or legislation that the next 10 cents would provide the phasing. Now, I will go back to the fact that in 2001, when the report was made to the legislature of the need for this system and adopted by the legislature, that did include a phasing, an annual phasing provision. So the fact we would have to come back annually and seek funding for additional phases was clearly understood. There was no legislative language, at least, that said 10 cents this year, 10 cents that year. This is the first time that we've come back and said we need to get it done. And I would clearly articulate to you the fact that we're up against some deadlines where people have antiquated systems. In 2013, they have to replace things, and the uncertainty of whether this backbone will in place rides heavy on our public safety officials as they try to make decisions about how they're going to provide communications and interoperable communications in the future.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Foley?
Madam Chair and Mr. Whitehead, what's the status then of this as it applies to those areas outside the metropolitan area?
Mr. Whitehead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the metropolitan area, and I would reference you all to about 2 weeks ago, the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security, came out with a evaluation of interoperable communications in the urban area, and we got a perfect score out of 6 urban communities out of 75 in this country to get a perfect score. And in large part, I would tell you that not only the build out of the system in the metropolitan area, in fact 9 counties of the metropolitan area including Chisago and Isanti, the backbone is in place, and the 7 counties of the traditional metropolitan area will be completed. In other words, every governmental entity in those 7 counties will be part of the operating on this common backbone by 2008. They're on a course to get that completed, and part of that is the not only having the system there, but have the relationships that are built through interoperable communications resulted in this very well evaluated urban area exercise that was done by the federal government. Beyond that, in 2005, phase three, which includes 23 counties outside of the metropolitan area in central Minnesota from St. Cloud going to the west out to the South Dakota border, and in southeastern Minnesota, were funded, and MnDOT's in the process presently of implementing that portion of the system. Stearns County, Goodhue County were already in place with the system, and building out from that. That'll be done by the third quarter of 2007. The backbone will be in place in those 23 counties. So what we're talking about is building in the 50 remaining counties in the state, which includes the southwestern portion of the state and a large portion of the central portion of the state, and then the northern portion of the state, getting that backbone in place.
Madam Chair, Mr. Whitehead, weren't we looking at trying to advance the development of that because of the serious consequences that arise without it?
Mr. Whitehead?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would agree with you that this is probably a nationally interoperable communications is a very high priority. Following September 11th, the legislature acted and, in essence, funded a portion of Phase 3, and but for some issues in the 911 fund that have been resolved and clearly addressed, we didn't get moving along at that particular point in time. And again, I would hearken to you that this needs to be a priority, that there are aging systems, the 2013 narrow banding requirement, and our absolute need for interoperable communications amongst all our public safety officials, and I talk about that broadly, not just police and fire, is a very high priority and needs to be addressed squarely. And I believe the governor's recommendation does that by providing the resources to ensure that we can get it done over the next 4 years.
Madam Chair, Mr. Whitehead, isn't it very likely that by the time you got this system built that you'll have to start looking at replacing it because of the technology advances and the changes on that?
Mr. Whitehead?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I really would be hard-pressed to say that, Senator. This system clearly, although technology is changing, there is nobody in there. Many states are building statewide systems, and this is the same technology they're all looking at. Nobody's looking at a Wi-Fi solution. And 20 years from now, that may be the new solution. And I would tell you that the RF portion of this network is just a small portion of the cost, 30 to 35%. Putting towers up, the connectivity between the towers, no matter what that new solution is, we still need that backbone to build upon. And so this is an investment in the future, and that RF element, what you call the 800 piece, which is 800, 700, and the trunk radio piece is just a small portion of the cost. And when I say a small portion, 35% of the cost, but that backbone will still be necessary for any technological change in the future.
Madam Chair, looking at it from a national perspective, and we can look at the 9/11 problem in New York and others, but realistically, we've got some serious problems in connectivity in the United States, and Minnesota is not exempt from that, from the way I read it. And that's why I raised this issue about maybe what dollars we're looking at here are clearly not sufficient to do the kinds of building and equipping that's really needed. Can you tell me what the status is of the systems throughout the state as far as connectivity is concerned?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as part of the governor's proposal, we're seeking to look at the opportunity to implement data in connection with the radio system. Is the demand for wireless spectrum, the ability to reach the squad cars, increasing? Yes, it is. And we're being proactive in saying, yes, this is the backbone. The next thing maybe to consider is data. Would that cost more? Yes, it may, getting data out to the squad cars throughout the state, the firefighters to the emergency medical people may, in fact, be a priority we have to address. But we still need that backbone in place to do it. And we believe this plan provides that basic backbone upon which we can build. And in answer to your question, would it cost more to do a data overlay with this? Yes, it would. but it's still part of our, you know, we're incorporating that strategy and looking at the opportunity. MNET, we're looking at the opportunity to leverage with MNET and say, you've got the IP connectivity between various centers in the state, and where can we use that and bolster that throughout the state? So I would say to you, Senator, that this is basically a voice system, but we're looking to the future to provide the backbone upon which we can build and address the communication needs for public safety into the future. And that we understand that communication needs are going to change, but we have to start somewhere. And a turnkey operation that answers all our problems for the next 20 years, I wish I could promise it to you. But I can promise you this is the backbone for building into the future and having the interoperable communication system that our public safety officials need.
Mr. Whitehead, some of the communities are talking about becoming a wireless community, you know, so that anywhere within the city you can, you know, use your wireless setups. Does that help this operation at all?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that what you're referring to is referred to as Wi-Fi type connectivity. It really doesn't, other than the fact that at some point, and that's where we get into the technology of the future, is there likely to be Wi-Fi public safety communication devices? You don't see them on the market now. But you will some point in the future, 15, 20 years, you may see them implemented. And that's when I was referring to the Senator Foley's question, is a number of states are implementing statewide systems. There is nobody looking at a public safety. That's something that you have to be able to count on for public safety for Wi-Fi connectivity. One of the big downsides to that is Wi-Fi require, you know, we build towers about every 20 miles. Wi-Fi requires towers about every 5 miles. So you talk about taking this overlay of infrastructure and add, you know, another 4 to 5 towers, you are talking about building the cost tremendously. And I think some of those questions will be answered as technology advances. But it's going to take a while, and it's going to take a while before it's up to public safety needs, the kind of system that you have to be able to count on when nothing else is working. And that's one of the reasons it costs a lot. It's a system built to be resilient and operate under any circumstances.
Just, Madam Chair, just one question. When you're looking at the metropolitan area here, and so are you saying now that if we had a disaster like they had in New Orleans or New York or any of those, that our agencies could communicate from the State Patrol to the Hennepin Sheriff to the Bloomington Police and all of those? Or is there a big gap in there where the officers can't talk to one another?
Mr. Whitehead.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I would tell you that based upon the evaluation by the Department of Homeland Security, we are in very good shape with respect to our ability to respond to an incident like that. There are no guarantees in life, but the system is built so that it's a common infrastructure. And the communication between the State Patrol, federal agencies, and everybody in the metropolitan area, we're in very good shape. And in 2008, when the entire metropolitan area is on the system, we ought to be in very good shape.
Okay. All right, next item, please.
The next item, Madam Chair, is the Crime Victim Reparations Program, and that detailed information is located on page 66 of your budget books. This is a request to increase the amount of general fund dollars that go to the Crime Victim Reparations Program by $500,000 for the coming biennium. Basically, the reason for this is that violent crime, particularly in the Minneapolis area, has risen recently, 11.5% increase in 2005. Therefore, more crime victims are seeking assistance. And program rules operate this program, and we've certainly implemented rules to reduce the reimbursement rates. However, we simply aren't able to keep up with the number of requests that we are getting from violent crime victims for reparation services. So that's what this request is responding to.
Okay.
The next item also relates to crime victims. That's the victim notification system. That request is located on page 71 of your books. By Minnesota state law, local police agencies have a response to notify a crime victim when the custody status of a defendant is reduced. So if somebody's picked up, they're put in jail on a domestic violence case or a sexual assault case or whatever kind of case, and their custody status is reduced, law enforcement has to notify the victim of that. What we've been able to implement in Minnesota through use of federal funds is an automated victim notification system so that it allows local jurisdictions to comply with the statutory notification requirements through use of this system. We were able to develop it and fund it with federal funds. Those funds have decreased, so the governor is asking for $910,000 for the coming biennium to fund that automatic notification system.
That was previously funded by Byrne grants? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
The U.S. Senate passed the bill, the Byrne grant bill, yesterday, so there's hope that some of that money will be coming back one of these days.
Any other questions or comments on that one? The next item is for our forensic to increase our forensic scientists at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. That budget detail is located on page 31 of your budgets. The governor is requesting to add 20 new forensic scientists to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Laboratory over the next two-year period. As you know, the BCA building was completed a few years ago. It was completed with the idea that there would be growth over the years. With the advancements in DNA evidence and the increased ability of the lab to do new and interesting lab tests, the request for lab services has grown exponentially over the past few years, and as a result, the turnaround time on case processing is not what we would like it to be. And so this request, again, is for 20 new forensic scientists so that we can reduce turnaround time on criminal cases.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, dealing with that, I've noted an increase in local labs and scientists, if you will. It seems that that's driven by the lack of adequate staff and whatever else at the BCA in order to do that, forcing the local sheriff or the local police departments to develop some. Is that according to working out the way you're trying to plan to have the most effective delivery of services? So where are they located, and why is this trend going in that direction?
Commissioner Ellison? Yeah. Commissioner Campion?
Senator, Madam Chair, Senator, this whole concept of turnaround time is a very complicated issue, and I think the BCA has tried to deal with it effectively over a number of years. The answer to your question is yes. 20 scientists would address the turnaround time in large measure, both in St. Paul and certainly in the Bemidji area. There's a laboratory, of course, in Bemidji that services about 35 counties in the north and northwest part of the state of Minnesota. There has been discussion, and there has been some interest in local units of government exploring the possibility of their building and developing their own forensic laboratories. To what extent that has any promise or not is a matter to be discussed. But I will say that both of these buildings, the legislature in its wisdom a number of years ago gave money through the bonding process and other appropriations to build two of some of the finest state-of-the-art building, forensic science buildings there is, at least in the upper Midwest, if not in the country. And those buildings were built with expansion in mind. It would be silly to build a building of that complexity and have it full the day it opened. So by best estimates, I think Frank Dolish, who is here and also can speak for himself, I think between those two buildings and depending on business practices, two shifts, for instance, shifts on weekends, those kinds of business rearrangements, probably some 50 additional scientists could go into both of those buildings.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, I take it that you're doing everything you can to encourage them to not develop labs and to take and utilize your facilities, and if needed, to increase the size of your facilities, the number of staff, or what?
Your question, Madam Chair, Senator, your question is, are we doing everything we can to discourage them? Is that your question?
No, Madam Chair, Commissioner, I'm interested in getting the most bang for the buck, and if you've got the facilities to do that, why, I don't know who in the greater Minnesota that is building those or even talking about building them, but that's the kind of thing that I've been tracking here lately, is that that there's likely to be some additional forensic labs and staffed and so forth by local units of government.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, again, I know there's been some discussion in some, at least in one pocket of the state, that there was some interest in doing that. Again, I don't know if that, I don't know to what extent that really will go forward or not. I don't know. It's my understanding it's in the discussion stage, and there's some attempt to solicit some additional support and advocacy, but whether that will really materialize or not, I don't know. I hope that, I'm not trying to avoid answering your question. I think that's what you asked me, Senator.
Okay, Senator Watt.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, to slice that question in a different way, we're not funding the 20 scientists because we just want to expand to fill the space. We have a need. I mean, it's needs-driven in that we have backlog and we have work that needs to be done. We just don't have the scientists to do the work, correct? And so if we add these 20 scientists, it would help expedite the cases that are currently on backlog or coming to us?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, you're correct. It's not that we're trying to fill a building. There is a backlog need, and it grows every year because more people submit evidence. There's more sophisticated tests being done, and certainly it's just the natural progression of things that it's kind of the if you build it, they will come kind of a concept. The two buildings were built to provide forensic science examinations in Bemidji and St. Paul, and more evidence is being turned in every year.
Commissioner Campion, I see in the budget book that one of the key measures is to reduce turnaround times to 30 days or less. What's the average turnaround time now?
Madam Chair, it's in excess of 30 days, I suspect, on an average. And again, it's kind of a difficult question to answer because I believe, for instance, in some in very important and high profile, not just high profile, but cases where there is a dangerous perpetrator, for instance, is out amongst the community. Those kind of examinations are done very, very quickly. It's not uncommon for instance, perhaps in St. Paul, as an example, with the two horrible rapes that went on. I think that evidence was turned around in a matter of seven days, 10 days, and they were sophisticated DNA analysis. It's different than the examination of a fingerprint, for instance. So. Depending on the urgency and the need, the turnaround time varies. It certainly might vary week by week sometimes, and depending on if a scientist is in tied up in court for a whole week or something like that. So there's a lot of variables, and it's a complicated issue. But the turnaround time probably is in excess, on an average, over 30 days, and certainly the goal would be to get it under 30 days.
Okay. All right. Proceed, please.
The next item is CRIMNET, additional funding for CRIMNET. That's located on page 29 of your budget book. The governor's recommending $15.5 million for CRIMNET development over the coming biennium. And we have people here that can provide much more detail than I can about the CRIMNET process. But basically, the projects that this $15.5 million will move forward are the capture and distribution that creates a single portal that will allow criminal justice users to access statewide repositories of information through a single point of entry. E-charging, develop an electronic system to prepare and transmit charging documents between law enforcement agencies, prosecution offices, and the courts. It's been something that we've been on the docket for a while. Enhanced biometric replaces existing live scan fingerprint units that are reaching the end of their life cycle. Allows for the purchase of more live scans and rapid ID or two fingerprint units with updated capability to capture and return different types of fingerprints, two print and slap prints, as well as palm and side of palm prints. This will help very much in terms of solving cases when people, most many times people don't leave a good, clear fingerprint at the crime scene, and so the ability to capture palm prints will allow us much greater capacity in solving crimes than we have currently. The Identity Access Management System. This creates a single sign-on system for all BCA statewide systems and provides a security service which determines the user identity and privileges. Identity Access Management is what that is called, implements user-to-user system and system-to-system security protocols so that we can determine who the person is that's accessing the information and determine the level of access to information that they have and keep that data then more secure. The Minnesota National Incident-Based Reporting System. This replaces a system that is 30 years old and is utilized by criminal justice agencies to report our crime data to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And then the NAME Event Index System, develop a statewide service system that will link people and events, eventually by a biometric such as a fingerprint, to provide accurate identification of individuals. So in the future, criminal justice records would be tied actually to a fingerprint. So we have less cases going into suspense files, and we are more accurately able to identify people with their criminal history record. I'm sure there are questions about CrimNet.
Okay, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where would the CrimNet be physically located, and by whom would it be operated?
I'm going to ask Mr. Good to come to the table because I'm anticipating several questions. But, Madam Chair, members of the committee, CrimNet is located within the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and operated through the BCA. Is that
Mr. Good?
I think, Senator Latz, that you should
Senator
look
Foley.
At the aspect there. Is the idea is to establish a place where the data is, and the BCA doesn't necessarily have the data there that they channel your query from that to the pickup at the one of the other points that are located on the line. So they've got the county attorneys and the courts and the public defenders and a whole variety. I think Mr. Good probably could fill you in on that, but it isn't like you normally would think of a network running from this building to the next. For example, it's totally different. So I guess maybe I've confused you enough, so I'll leave it to
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I know there were some concerns in the past about the involvement, I believe it was the State Police Chiefs Association, if I'm remembering correctly, that had housed and operated at least a significant portion of CrimNet, and there are questions about whether it had legal authority to control access to the data and the ability to prevent the leaking of data to inappropriate users. There were lots of data privacy questions that arose about this, and being able to protect the integrity of the information and make sure that that the different levels of privacy that would get attributed to the different types of data would remain at those levels and couldn't be accessed by inappropriate persons. I know this is a pipeline that runs statewide, and you want to be able to have the appropriate people get access to the appropriate data. But, for example, if data is supposed to be expunged, or if charges don't result after an arrest, what level of data is accessible and to whom? Out of a police department's or a sheriff's department's database is a very important question to protect privacy of individuals as well as to facilitate effective law enforcement. I know there are a lot of hearings in the House. I sat through a lot of them on the Civil Law Committee there my first 2 years in the House, but I haven't heard what the follow-up on any of that was, and maybe we can get an update on some of that too.
Okay, Mr. Good.
Madam Chair, my name is Dale Good. I'm the Executive Director of the CrimNet program at the BCA. And that's maybe the first thing I should say is that CrimNet is a program. So Senator Foley is right. There's a number of different sources of data, the court data that the Department of Corrections, the incident data that you were referring to, Senator. And what CRIMNET is trying to do is to make sure that we have the appropriate data accessible to our criminal justice practitioners with appropriate data policy, you know, with the right of the individual, if it's private data, to see it, or if it's confidential, to not see it. And then to make that available in the future, make that available in a consolidated, useful fashion. If you look, and I'll address specifically your law enforcement record in a minute, but if you look what's happened over the last 5 or 6 years, you look back at 2000, we had, and we've been going around talking to members, what we had was we had cards, fingerprint cards, being mailed to the BCA, learning identity in 3 months. We had Polaroids for booking photos. We had no release information. We had no statewide probation information. We had no statewide detention information. We had no statewide court record information. We had no statewide incident, law enforcement and incident information. We had no serious juvenile felony information. So part of what's happened over this 5 or 6 year period is trying to fill these gaps, plug these holes in information that Minnesota criminal justice agencies did not have access to, did not exist. We've succeeded in doing that, but we, as I think what Senator Foley was alluding to, now we have to, are going forward, and our budget proposal going forward is to make that, link it back to individuals through fingerprints, make it secure based on appropriate data policy and roles, and then deliver that back in a squad car. You shouldn't have to spend on your terminal, your MDT, tabbing between 8 or 9 different computer systems. We have probation officers looking. We filled the holes in information. Now they're looking at multiple computer systems to support the judge at an arraignment, at a release hearing. So that's kind of the nutshell of what we're saying going forward. With specific reference to the law enforcement records, the system that was shut down, the MJNO system, there were some issues with mixed data classifications and with security. The Department of Public Safety has built a replacement to that called CYBRS, Comprehensive Incident-Based Reporting System. We always have, us IT guys have to have acronyms, you know. So CYBRS, we have the CYBRS system has been built. It's been built with very clear rules around the data classifications. In the 2005 session, we went forward with a bill. Representative Holberg sat on the executive committee of the CYBRS executive committee in terms of what the law enforcement agencies wanted out of CYBRS. And we had language approved by the legislature with specific classification of the data, this comprehensive law enforcement incident data going into CYBRS. So we do have that guidance from the legislature on the data classification for this law enforcement data. The current status of it is that the system, the back-end system, is built. Now we're starting to work with the local agencies with different plans on how to do this to get that information from those local agencies in accordance with this data policy and the rules around it. So absolutely, I think one of the changes going forward in terms of having learned some hard lessons, having the program learn some hard lessons in 2003, 2004, is to be very, very forthright with you, coming forward with clear data policy, being very mindful of that, making sure we dot the I's and cross the T's. One of the initiatives in here, this name event index service, last session, in anticipation of an investment in this, we obtained a classification for the name event index service from the legislature that's already in place. So we are committed to making sure that we are providing appropriate data policy around these systems going forward.
Senator Lass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Good, is that?
Yes.
What kind of access does the subject of the data have?
Mr. Good.
Access by the subject is governed by Chapter 13, by areas of 299. Currently it depends on the system, so that's still tied to the record, still tied to the specific record. If you take the example of CYBRS, the guidance around the CYBRS comprehensive law enforcement incident data is that the data might be public locally, but it comes to the central repository and it's confidential, not accessible to the subject for some period of time, after some period of time, it becomes private if there's no active investigation. So it's tied around the notion of an active criminal investigation. So it is complex depending on the system. Each system has its own, or each record type of record has its own current statutory framework for access and accessibility of the subject. So for example, warrant information before it's served is not public. It's not private because, you know, until you serve it, once it's served, then it becomes public at the local agency. So it is a complicated area.
Senator Lance. Just one follow-up. Is there any mechanism in place for some ongoing oversight, review, analysis of data classifications and access by all the persons or the parties that need access for those purposes? Is there an oversight committee in the legislature, or is it designated some extra mixed group that's watching these things?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's a very good question. In fact, in statute currently under 299C65 is a policy group and a task force. And the policy group, the commissioner is the chair of that, and it's the Commissioner of Finance, Commissioner of Public Safety, Commissioner of Corrections, the state CIO, four members of the judicial branch appointed by the Chief Justice, and the chair and vice chair of a task force, a 35-member statutory body that represents, you know, two chiefs, two sheriffs, two public defenders, two judges, two court administrators, some public members, some victims, and they deal specifically with some of these data privacy, data access issues. In fact, we have a bill that you'll see coming forward that was approved by the task force and the policy group that deals with subject with a easier access for the subject as appropriate. And it's coming from this body, this statutory body, this task force.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just speaking from experience over the years, and I think that's probably what Senator Latz was talking about. The sheriffs at one time had a program, then the chiefs had a program. The state was not moving along. I just really applaud the efforts that are going forth here now. I think all the sheriffs and chiefs are going to say, finally, this has happened. We're going to have one central place to get all our information from. It's going to be under one roof, so I applaud your efforts here. It's a great thing.
Senator, if I could offer just one other piece of information to provide some comfort to Senator Latz. There's a policy group. There's a task force. Mr. Good talked about that. I would say the conscience of the task force in terms of data privacy issues has been Senator Foley. I've been going to task force meetings for 2 years. It's been an issue that Senator Foley has been center stage on, and again, he's kind of the conscience, if you will, of the task force on those issues. One last thing, if I would offer for clarity purposes, if you look at the third bullet under CRIMNET, it talks about enhanced biometric technology, essentially. We all understand $15.5 million is an awful lot of money, but almost a third of that is money that goes to buy technology for local units of government. Those are live scans that have a shelf life. This is an initiative to replace those live scans, and that goes out to local units of government throughout the across the state of Minnesota.
Okay. All right. Other questions? If not, continue.
On the flip side of the page, the next one is the Emergency Disaster Assistance State Match. That's located on page 13 of your budget books. This provides a match for federal disaster assistance that we received from the federal government this year. And all of these funds are returned to the communities that were impacted by that particular disaster. The next one is the Disaster Assistance Reform Act, which is on page 13. This provides additional state match funds to better ensure the state can meet its match obligations in the future. When we have a disaster, and we've had 14 in the past, I can't remember how many years, but the past several years, we've had 14 major disasters, we receive federal money. And we have to match that money with state money. We have about $200,000 per year in our budget now. This adds $250,000 to that budget for match money per year. And it helps ensure that if we have a disaster and need to match the federal money with state money, that we have that available so that we can move forward quickly with our application to the federal government.
Question? Maybe this is not the best place to ask the question, but I sent a letter out mostly to the Commissioner of DNR, and I think I sent one to you too, Commissioner, on a tornado incident down in Le Sueur County near Cleveland. It made, you know, there was the governor went down there and there was some publicity, but it didn't meet the criteria for federal aid. And nobody claimed responsibility to pay for the cleanup costs of all the debris that flew into the public waters. Is that something you should be, I mean, I'm trying to get a meeting together to figure out how we can deal with that in the future and develop a protocol. Is that strictly a DNR issue, or should you be involved in that? Yeah, Chris Idy has spent a lot of time down in Los Cerritos.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, my name is Chris Idy. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. I think that the Department of Public Safety should be involved in any kind of coordination with state agencies where disaster is concerned. Okay. The governor's budget does not support those incidents that don't meet the federal criteria, however.
Well, I can't, Madam Chair, I kind of figured that, but sometime this session, I mean, just so you all know, you probably saw on TV the tornadoes that went down through Cleveland. And it was really kind of odd that, you know, all these houses and building materials got blown into the lake, and nobody claimed they had a duty to clean it up. And I sent a letter to Commissioner Merriam at the time, and he basically said, yeah, we don't have a duty. It's public waters, but it's not our responsibility either. And you know, it's one of those things. Somebody has to
do it.
And so I'm going to, at some point, I'll be asking, I don't know if we ask for the money here or if I have to go to the budget for the DNR, but I just wanted to put it on the radar scope right now. So thanks. I knew you wouldn't have the money, though, right now.
Okay, other questions? If not, continue.
So why don't you wait for me? The next one is the pandemic flu preparations. The request is for $2.2 million. That detail is located on page 15 of your budget books. Basically, this ensures the coordination of state agency infectious disease pandemic preparedness activities and the provision of assistance to local emergency managers to increase readiness in the event of a pandemic flu. The next one is the gang and drug task forces. The request is for $2.5 million. It's located on page 68 of your budget books. This is to maintain consistent support for the gang and drug task forces located throughout the state of Minnesota. At the time we put this budget proposal together, we certainly were anticipating a continued reduction of our burn grant funds. As Senator Higgin mentioned, there was the burn grant funding was passed this week out of the Senate Appropriations Committee. We don't know for sure what's going to happen with that budget. And so this is to ensure that there is consistent funding for those efforts in the years to come.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, can we go back to the pandemic flu preparation, the $2.2 million? I believe the governor's budget appropriated $21 million. Is that right?
Something like
$21 million for that. How is that going to coordinate with the $2.2 million? To me, $21 million, personally, seems like a lot. We could kind of include preparation with the local law enforcement or health departments and have it all done there. So, what is your $2.2 million going to do?
Senator Higgins, Senator Rosen, I'm going to refer to Chris Idy to answer that question.
Chris Idy, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the $2.2 million over the next biennium really focuses on state agency preparation and local preparation that is separate from public health. The $21 million over the next few years in the governor's budget really is looking at the purchase of pharmaceuticals such as the Tamiflu, some ventilators, respirators, the kinds of stockpiles needed for the public health response. Because we're a partnership with the Department of Health, they gave us for this year, out of the $5 million that the legislature appropriated last year, they gave public safety $2.9 million to then subgrant to local units of government and state agencies for the beginning of preparedness. And the coordination at the local and state level, which is why we're asking for that to continue over the next biennium.
Madam Chair, Ms. Idy, is this $2.2 million going to buy more equipment or radios, or what exactly do you have to do to prepare beyond the $2.9 million that was appropriated last year?
The $2.2 million over the next biennium really is to continue the exercising and the training and some of the equipment that's needed for preparing for the pan flu. Things such as if a county determines that that they would be practicing social distancing with plexiglass in their emergency operations center or at certain areas in the county courthouse where there really needed to be face-to-face contact with clients. Those are the kinds of equipment that could be purchased with this. But most of this money will really be spent for ensuring that they can maintain their training of response, their continuity of operations, continuity of government plans, and exercise those plans, which is an expensive venture for a local unit of government.
So, Ms. Ide, does this all go to the as grants to the local units?
Madam Chair, out of the $1.1 million each year, about $650,000 will go to local units of government. We then will maintain some coordinators and planners for that at the state level, along with ensuring that Department of Employer Relations has a planner that can coordinate the service continuation and continuity of government plans among all the state agencies.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ide, do you get any direction from the federal government as far as planning and spending of the monies such as this? I mean, is there any federal monies coming your direction?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there is money coming for public health, but not for the emergency management function from the federal government.
Madam Chair, do you get any direction as far as how to prepare, or is it something that you develop within your own department?
There is some general guidance on how to prepare because this is considered a catastrophic event. And so we have some guidelines from the federal government for incorporating catastrophic events into our emergency operations plan. However, specific to pandemic, there are some implementation guidelines for that. However, we do mostly the development of local templates and local guidance from the state level, not from the federal level.
Thank you.
Ms. Ide, do you have any sense of, among all the various departments in the state, how many people and how much money we spend on preparing for the pandemic flu that might come sometime?
Just for preparing.
Madam Chair, this year we passed on around $900,000 to other state agencies for state agency preparation. And that also includes either hiring a contractor or a service continuation planner, developing training for the employees, a coordinated training program. And as a matter of fact, week after next, there's going to be state agency continuity of government exercise, particular to pan flu. Those are the things that we funded this year.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I think Commissioner, I'm concerned about the gang and drug task force and other similar ones. We had that finance one also. But what I'm concerned about is an article that I read in the St. Paul paper a while back about the apparently it was some participants in the gang task force that were working at some other location. And what I'm trying to figure out from this thing is what's the level of supervision that goes with these task forces? Do we have some chain of command that you or others supervise or manage?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, there is a structure set up by statute. There is an oversight council, if you will, that is created by statute both in the financial crimes task force area and also in the gang and drug enforcement area. So local law enforcement people and or criminal justice practitioners, some be it county attorneys and some other people in the criminal justice, have immediate or oversight over the activities of either one of these task forces. In addition to that, I think the role of the Department of Public Safety is to ensure that the money and the policies are implemented and the money is spent in a manner consistent with the legislative intent. So there's a level of supervision or oversight by the commissioner's office, by the oversight board, and then there's certainly local units of government that send supervisors at various levels of management expert with various levels of management expertise to operate and supervise the day-to-day operation of the officers assigned. In the drug world, for instance, each drug task force has a board that oversees that particular task force, so that there's still there's an additional level of supervision on the local or regional level, and that is comprised generally of chiefs and sheriffs who have officers assigned to that drug task force. I would say one other feature of supervision or management in the Office of Justice Programs, which is in the Department of Public Safety, and through its individuals who work in that area, have formulated a task force manual, if you will, a best practices report writing manual and how to conduct investigations, best practices, if you will. And that, although drug task forces and other task forces aren't mandated to follow that manual, it is strongly encouraged and by my understanding, by most of the people involved do follow the manual because it is extremely helpful, and it's an illustration of best practices in any number of different areas. So there's just an awful lot of levels of supervision and oversight in most of these areas.
Thank you.
Okay, continue, please.
The next one is the School Safety Center for $400,000. So that's the request for the biennium. The details located on page 70. This really has arisen out of requests that both our department and the Department of Education have had over the years from local school districts and local police and sheriffs about how to really ensure a safe school environment. Obviously, there's been great concern as a result of the school shootings that have occurred here in Minnesota and in other parts of the state or other parts of the country, to really look at how can school districts work effectively with local law enforcement in doing threat assessments, looking at the school environment and how to ensure a safe environment, how to develop crisis plans, how to respond in the event of a school shooting. And so this really is a request to provide that level of technical assistance to local school districts and local police and sheriffs.
Senator Ingebretson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Has there been any effort at all with your department in looking into the SRO program, nationally known SRO program, just getting off the ground, student resource officer?
Senator Higgins, or Madam Chair, Senator Ingebretson, I believe that there's been a group that has met over a period of time, and a group that has met that actually helped us develop this proposal, and I believe that they have reviewed that program and other programs that have been operating around the country, but I don't know the details on that.
Perhaps
Assistant Commissioner Leslie, who's attended those meetings, could shed more light on that.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Tim Leslie, Assistant Commissioner. Madam Chair and Senator Ingebretson. Yeah, we discussed a lot of different options for school districts, and especially rural school districts talked about the need for SROs. And the recommendations will be coming to this committee, I believe, mid-February. The task force met four different days. It was a cross-section of folks, school administrators, school principals, teachers, law enforcement, fire service personnel, emergency service personnel. And then out of that group, we had a report with findings, and that report is coming to you for your consideration.
Okay. Senator Moore.
No, I lost track because I was so engaged in your description of the SROs. The school safety centers. Commissioner, I'm a little bit lost. How is this intended to operate? Is it going to operate out of the department? Where is this one-time money to create something? Is it intended that this would be an ongoing thing? What's the larger context?
Would you like to?
Sure.
Mr. Leslie.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator
Leslie.
Moi. Good question. I think the vision for this was to create a center in the Department of Public Safety that would offer technical assistance, best practices, oversight, and assistance to school districts and administrators on how to make sure that they're thinking about their relationships with law enforcement and emergency responders, and in putting an all-hazards approach into planning for school safety, so that I'm not sure 400,000 would get us to where you'd have a big staff, probably web-based or virtual, a virtual school safety center kind of concept. So it's going to have to be worked out. The models we've looked at are Kentucky, Colorado, Tennessee. There's some all over the state, but there are some over the nation, excuse me. So this would be a starting point.
Mm. Well, Madam Chair, my thinking is that I think the schools have identified this a need for a long time, and I don't know in other areas, but certainly in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and particularly in St. Paul, you know, our schools are struggling with how to pay for the peace officers who, you know, come to the schools to help manage things at the schools. And I'm wondering if, this could be the beginning or this could be the start of a conversation to go in the direction of looking at how we can, I think that this is going in the right direction, and I'm excited to see this as part of, you know, the governor's agenda. But I'd like to work with you on this because I think maybe there's a way we could think about this differently so that we don't spend a lot of money creating something going in one direction where maybe the need is asking us to do something else in a different direction.
Okay. Senator Ingres.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, would like to be added to that list. I actually have the opportunity to have that intense training in Memphis with my local officials and the SRO training, and unless you've really been there and understand it, it's hard to understand, but it's an excellent program. And how to get the funding going or some match funding, maybe from your budget in the future, entertain something like that.
Sounds like there's some.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore and Senator Ingerson, we'd be happy to work with you on this concept.
Senator Neville?
Just a little technical point, but I haven't, you know, in the past the budget books had proposed FTEs on a lot of things. I don't see that they're in on a lot of the new requests here, at least they're not for this one. Are they? Or am I not looking in the right spot?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, we aren't asking for an FTE for this particular item, no. But there
I noticed the kind of the ambiguity. You weren't sure if it was going to be a staff person or a web-based. Is that generally, though, are you still listing FTEs if you're going to be adding new staff for programs? Is that in the budget book?
Madam Chair,
it is.
Senator
okay.
Neville, it
All
is
right.
located throughout. If you look throughout the book, we didn't highlight it on this one-page document, but if you look throughout the budget book, you will see some additional FTEs.
Okay, thanks.
Madam Chair, the final item is the compensation adjustment. As you all know, we have had salary settlements negotiated by unions throughout the years, and over the past 4 years, state agencies have not received any sort of compensation adjustment from the legislature. So this year, the governor is asking for a compensation adjustment for this particular committee that amounts to $2.1 million. And you will see that budget detail throughout the book as you read through.
Okay. Questions? I have a question about the things you haven't talked about in the budget book. The other Office of Justice programs all seem to be taking a financial cut. The Battered Women's Shelter Service, the Crime Victim Assistance Grants, the crime or the law enforcement and community grants. Am I reading it wrong, or?
Madam Chair, that is a little bit confusing in these budget books. What happens is that the legislature appropriates one-time funds, And when the legislature appropriates one-time funds, then those show up as a reduction for the next biennial budget. And so last year, it also, if we have a reduction in federal funds, it shows up as a budget reduction. So although it looks like here we're cutting programs, we are not cutting any programs for the next biennium.
Okay, and so why does... is there a way in the budget books that you can tell us that?
Well,
because, I mean, you know, if you look on page 79, the law enforcement and community grants, you know, fiscal year 2007 is $30 million, and governor's recommendation for 08 and 09 are 16 and 17. That's a lot of money. That if you say that 30 is ongoing, how come we're seeing 16 and 17?
If you look up above, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for instance, if you look at on page 79, if you look at under statutory appropriations, it says federal money. You'll look at the federal money we received in 2006 was $13 million, then in 2000 it's $17 million, then in 2008 it's $7 million. Mm-hmm. So you'll see a significant reduction there in federal dollars that are coming to the department. And then also, there, like I say, every year the legislature appropriates some one-time funds for various different activities, and then those are backed out of the base budget. So I know I was confused, too, when I saw it, and sometimes the budget documents are confusing. I don't know how else to better explain it, but we are not proposing reductions to those programs for the coming biennium.
So somewhere along the line, the decrease in federal funds is getting filled in from somewhere? Or am I going to have to go find money to do that?
Madam Chair, the reduction in federal funds that will impact programs are reflected in the budget requests that we're making to you. The one area is in the Gang and Drug Task Force. Also with federal...
That's one area, but what about these areas?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where all those federal funds were going, but sometimes those are one-time funds as well, one-time grants that we get for various sorts of proposals. And so when we have a budget cut that impacts this division or the programs, for instance, in the Office of Justice Programs, we would come to the state and ask that you replace those funds. But that, I think your question relates to battered women's programs, sexual assault programs, general crime programs, the various different crime victim programs. We are not proposing any cut in those programs for the coming biennium. Maybe if that's clearer. The other thing is that Mr. Boyd have just pointed out that there were $3.1 million in one-time funds that the legislature gave us last fiscal year that aren't that we are not receiving. So that gets backed out of the budget if it's a one-time appropriation that the legislature makes.
Right.
Madam Chair?
Is that clear?
No.
Just to follow Senator Neville. Just to follow up that series of questions, you're not proposing a cut. What, are you proposing level funding, or is there some increase?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, for everything that that we are proposing, there is level funding with the exception of the items on this page where we're asking for increased funding.
Okay. All right.
But everything else is requested at its base budget as it was last biennium.
So, Madam Chair, you're not even asking for inflationary increases on those?
With the exception of a compensation adjustment, that is correct.
I'm still stuck on the Gang and Drug Task Force increase that's on the two-page document, and that replaces federal funds. And I get that, but I don't see anything here that replaces the federal funds on these other pages.
There's none.
And are you saying there is none?
We are not, Madam Chair, I'm saying that we are not making a request to replace those federal funds. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you where all those federal funds went, but a lot of times we receive one-time grants from the federal government for various different types of programs that have a beginning date and an end date. But we are not requesting that you fill in for the loss of those particular federal funds. The only request that we have for replacement of federal funds is in the area of the victim notification system that I mentioned that we were funding with Byrne, and then for the Gang and Drug Task Force, we are anticipating a further reduction in Byrne. We've had several reductions over the years, and we, at the time we prepared this, we were projecting a further reduction. We don't know what's going to happen with that, so we asked for those funds as well.
So to beat a dead horse, the state funds for these programs stays the same, but they have lost one-time money and they have lost federal funds, so they basically have way less money than they had last biennium. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure which programs are you referring
to? I'm still on page 79.
Okay, for the Office of Justice Programs, Madam Chair, we are not proposing any reductions in any programs over what they received last biennium.
Total collection of funds.
Total collection of funds. We are not reducing anybody's state funds.
State funds. I said total collection of funds.
Madam Chair.
All
sources, there is a reduction. We are not asking for a replacement of federal funds. When you referred specifically to battered women, sexual assault, general crime, and abused children, they are not receiving a reduction in federal funds either. So there will not be a reduction to those programs in either state or federal funds over what they received last biennium.
All right, I'll quit.
Madam Chair, also, I would just direct your attention to there is a federal funds summary at the back of the budget book, which is a lot of fun to read.
I tried.
It starts on page 88. And goes on from there, and you will see all of the various different federal grants that the agency receives, the amount of dollars, and some detail on that, which may help clarify the issue for you.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, I'm going to move off the subject, so if you have other questions.
Go right ahead.
All right. I'd like to go back to looking at the Emergency Disaster Assistance State Match and the Disaster Assistance Reform Act, the $1.1 million and the $500,000. Can you walk us through a little bit the first, the state match? Can you explain, talk a little bit about that, and then the rationale for the $1.1 million, is there a specific federal amount that's coming in that's requiring us to raise that match? If we don't do it, do we lose it? How does it all work?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, first of all, let me talk about the $1.1 million, and I'll ask Chris Ady to come up, too, because I may say something that is incorrect. But whenever we have a disaster, we get federal funds, but we have to match it with state funds. And so this $1.1 million is a request to match the federal money that we received for the flooding that occurred in the Red River Valley last spring of 06. So we got federal funds to cover that disaster, and we need to match those federal funds with $1.1 million and give that money to the local units of government that incurred the expenses as part of that disaster. Now, and then did you have another question?
On this point, Madam Chair, how much federal dollars did we get?
Madam Chair, Senator Moa, we received $5.5 million.
Madam Chair, and so if we don't set aside this $1.1 million, some of this $5.5 goes back to the feds?
Madam Chair, Senator Moa, the locals would have to pick up the entire 25% share. Traditionally, the state picks up 15%, and the local unit of government picks up 10% of that of the 25%. Non-federal share.
Oh.
Madam Chair, is that 15-10 split, is that statutory? Or just policy?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, no, that's just been past practice.
Okay.
And then, Madam Chair, Senator Moore, and Ms. Ide can correct me if I'm wrong, but the Disaster Assistance Reform Act is to help get us out of the situation that we're in right now at this table is that every time there's a disaster, if we don't have enough money in our state match account, we have to come back to the legislature and ask for the money. If the legislature is out of session when the disaster occurs, then there could be some time delay. And so we just want to increase the match amount to give us a better chance of having the money on hand if we should need it in the event of a disaster. And I'll ask Ms. Idy to correct anything that I've said that isn't quite accurate.
Madam Chair, that is correct. One of the main reasons that we do want to increase our base budget by that $250,000 is because of the individual and household program, which is when there's a disaster that affects individual families, we do have to make sure that we pay our 25% within 30 days of an invoice from the federal government. So when we certify when we are requesting a declaration of a major disaster, then we have to say that we have the money to pay 25% of the individual family eligible costs within 30 days of an invoice from the federal government. If the legislature is not in session at that time, we cannot make our payment, and therefore we would not be eligible to apply for that money.
Senator Moore. So, Madam Chair, Ms. Idy, we currently have an account set up where we have disaster money sitting in there right now.
That's correct.
And how much is in the account?
Right now, it's about $200,000 that we have on an annual basis to provide state match.
So that's ongoing?
That's ongoing.
On an annual basis, how much have we accumulated in that account?
It goes back to the general fund if it's not used in a fiscal year.
And so right now in the base there's that amount, and we want to add the $500,000 on top.
We want to add the $250,000 annually
on top.
Correct.
And how many times have we used up that money, and how many times has it gone back to the general fund in the last, say, couple of bienniums?
Madam Chair, Senator Moe, we have used that more than that money every single year in the last 10 years.
Senator Neville?
Well, I was just going to ask why you don't figure out what you need and we set up a fund and let it build up to that.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, and then you come and ask us for more when you run out. But did you think about that instead of just asking for... You want to be able to spend $450,000 a year, $900,000 over a biennium. Is that the right amount? And if it is, why don't we just build it up to maybe $1 million and maybe even automatically trigger something if it gets down to $200,000? Did you think about asking for it that way?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I think that the reluctance was to ask for large amounts of money that we weren't projecting that we would necessarily need. And so we were trying to reach a middle ground here to get a little bit more than what we have had currently, but not ask for something that seemed artificial. And so this was the middle ground that we reached. And certainly the legislature may have other ideas of what you'd like to do with this, but that was our thinking.
Well, Madam Chair, you said you spend more than $200,000 every year. What has been the average amount that you've spent?
Our average match has been about $4 million a year.
$4 million a year?
And you're asking for half a million?
They're doing
it's a little yeah. spent.
So you come back and ask us for special appropriations, particular... You come to this committee for that or other committees?
Madam Chair,
I don't remember that.
We come to this committee.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. Now my memory's not as good as Mr.
And we and Madam Chair, Senator Neville, the request has never been turned down.
Right.
So I think part of the deliberation here was we have never been turned down by the legislature when we have asked for these funds. So we could ask for more up front and have it sitting in the account, or we could continue current practice, which is to ask for it when we need it. This was sort of a middle ground, and that's what we came up with.
Mr.
Turner?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, during the budget crisis of 2003, this was one of the things that we cut. We cut their base budget by, I think, almost $2 million a year. And decided to just pay as we go with deficiencies. And this would just kind of it's the first step into getting a base budget for disaster relief. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Other questions? Is there anybody in the audience who wants to comment on what we've heard from the Department of Public Safety about their budget today? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the time.
We're adjourned.
I am just